The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Preparing the Ruins, the 2015 Annual Conference Recordings, copyright 2015. If you have purchased this recording, you may make additional copies for use by your school. You may not sell copies of the recording, nor post it on the Internet. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at www.accsedu.org.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I think we'll go ahead and get started since it's about 9:51 according to my iPhone. So this morning, you are in a workshop entitled, as you can see, Teaching Effective Rhetoric School Science Courses. Now, if you don't teach rhetoric school science, it won't be that you won't have any information that you can use. You will walk away today, I'm hoping at least, with some information or techniques or ideas that you can use, whether you teach in the phonics or grammar school, logic school, or the rhetoric school. Though because I teach high school or rhetoric school science, I entitled my workshop this way. So let me introduce myself. I'm Darla McDonald, and I teach at Cary Christian School in Cary, North Carolina. And I have four children, actually, who range in age from 13 to 4. So my household and my life is very full. I'm very busy. And it's really fun because my oldest child now is really taller than me. I feel like the shrimp of the family. So if you know what that's like, it's an interesting stage of life to finally have your children get bigger than you. But anyway, before we get started, I'd like to actually go ahead and have or pray and have God bless our time together today. So let's go ahead and bow our heads and close our eyes. Dear God, we just thank you so much for this time together. Lord, I pray that you would bless it, that anything that I say, Lord, would be honoring to you, that this would be a helpful workshop for those who have come to attend, and Lord, that you would strengthen us in our callings as teachers, as educators, that we might continue to raise a generation of disciples for you. And we just pray all this in your Son, Jesus' name. Amen. So please let me know at any time today if you can't hear or see anything. The workshop is quite interactive. You're actually going to be doing some talking, which is going to be exciting. I don't know about you, but I get tired of sitting and listening. So I'm going to have you guys be doing a lot of work. But I might be teaching in Cary, North Carolina, but I am a Marylander at heart. Any other fellow Marylanders in the room? Woohoo! Awesome. Where are you from? Awesome. I'm from Annapolis originally. Do you recognize where I'm at in the pictures? I'm at College Park. Well done. So I'm a graduate of the University of Maryland at College Park, and my undergraduate degree is in biology. I was actually a pre-med major during my time there. You can actually see my four children in front of Testudo, the Diamondback Terrapin of the University of Maryland, and my husband kind of off to the corner there. We were at University of Maryland recently. So come on in as we're walking in. I'm actually also in the process of completing a master's degree at North Carolina State University in science education, so you kind of know a little bit about my background. Now, I have to tell you, it's an honor to stand before you this morning because I have been in your seat many times before. I have been a classical Christian educator for about 10 years, and I have attended at least 6 of these conferences before, so I have sat in your seat many, many times. Now, I have to tell you, during those times at ACCS, I really enjoyed the workshop. I mean, I had some fabulous speakers, great topics. But I don't know about you, but I yearned for someone to talk about how they actually taught. So what do I mean by that? Many workshops are about the philosophy of science or natural philosophy, or they would talk about integrating the humanities with the sciences. And those are all great topics, do not get me wrong. And I have always walked away from ACCS inspired to continue my endeavor as a teacher. I have learned a lot, but I just prayed for somebody to tell me, this is how I did it. I don't know if you're in that same boat, but that's where I was always coming from. So my hope today is that you will leave this workshop with tangible, practical ideas, methods, and techniques that you can use in your classroom this fall. And I'm literally sharing work of my students, videos of my students. You're going to see a lot of what I actually do in the classroom today as we're together. I gave you the warning, it's very interactive. So I will be calling on you if you don't participate. Yes, this is like school. I'm going to have you do group work. This is going to be so exciting. So are you ready? I'm ready. All right, wake up, let's go. All right. How many of you are trained teachers, meaning you graduated from college with some sort of teaching degree, training, anything? Raise your hand. Nice to have you proud. Wow, that's awesome, but it's still only half of you. Only half of you have actually ever received training. Now, was your teacher training effective? Yes, no, you can just shake. Why? No? Okay, you can hit your hand now. So, all right, go for it. There. So you learned on the job, didn't you? You walked into your classroom and you figured out what worked and what didn't work. Absolutely. But you stop and think about, we have such an important job. We are training the next generation. And yet half of us, if not more, really, have no idea how to do our job. I mean, think about it, really. I wake up daily and say, Lord, help me to be a godly teacher, to be a godly witness to these young men and women. Help me to make a difference. And then I try to glean from others from the past and who are part of my life now on how to be an effective teacher. So I hope that you find some of the things that I share today helpful for you. But anyway, when I started teaching back in 2001, I was pretty much fresh out of college. Again, I had thought I wanted to be a doctor, so I had no teacher training at all. I literally was given a textbook by my administrator. She was excited because I had a science degree. Literally. Girl, I'm so excited you're going to be teaching. Here's our book. Go for it. Okay. I had no idea what I was doing. So how did you think, or how do you think I taught that first year? By the textbook, and I was taught the way? Amen. We all do it. We all teach the way we have been taught. Now let's share how were we taught. And I know we have different generations in here, but American education has not changed that much in the generations covered within this room. So how were you taught? Lecture. Absolutely. I was lectured to for years and years and years. That's how I was taught. And so how do you think I taught that first year of teaching? I lectured. Absolutely. Maybe this sounds familiar to you. You start a new unit. You sit and lecture for a few days. Your students are fervently taking notes into their notebooks. They maybe even ask questions. Maybe you ask questions of them. Then what do? Oh, let's do an experiment. Oh, a couple days later, we'll review and take a what? And then we do it all over again. Unit after unit, chapter after chapter. Absolutely. This whole methodology that you and I were taught with, and that many of us actually still use, is called a lecture methodology. So lecture, experiment, review, then test. Sound familiar? Are you living here still? Yeah? Some of us are. Absolutely. But this methodology has the teacher as the transmitter of knowledge. That's really where this methodology, this idea comes from. The teacher is the transmitter of knowledge. And what I do is that I transmit via my voice to my students the information they need to know. This is where that idea that students say, well, what do I need to know, comes from. Because they're used to you being the transmitter of knowledge. So they sit there and they take their notes and listen. Okay, is this going to be on the test? Because all they see you as is a transmitter of knowledge. They don't see you as anything different. And they see education as this game that they have to get and you have to give. That's the game that they think school is. But does this lecture-driven methodology really work? Really? What does lecture-driven methodology actually produce? Memorizers. What else? Because where do you think this methodology came from? Any historical knowledge? I actually think, from Prussia. I thought you said Depression at first. I think it was before the Depression. Yes, it was from Prussia, absolutely. It's a widget mentality, right? We are making the man to do his job. So we tell him how to do his job, and he goes and does his job, and he's now a good member of society. right? It's that whole humanistic historical background that this comes from. I don't want to dive into that today, but I just want you to know this is where this comes from. This lecture-driven methodology, is it classical? What do you think? I'm going to argue no. It's not classical at all. And yet, if you were to walk into our classrooms, what would you be finding? This methodology. We've got to stop it and stop it now. So this is where we're headed today. As classical Christian educators, we say that we're in the business of forming lifelong learners, problem solvers, and thinkers. And yet, if we utilize this technology, we do nothing except succeed in developing little parrots. And I'm supposed to be teaching in the rhetoric school. I don't think they're supposed to be parroting back to me anymore. But that's all we produce with this lecture-driven methodology. Now, before I go any further, I want to give credit to two gentlemen, one of which who is here at this conference, which is John Mays. And if you've never looked at any of John Mays' materials or had a chance to speak with him, you need to, because he has some great textbooks out there. I have learned quite a bit from him. I have in the outline, you can totally tell I'm a teacher. I put all the sources on your outline. You've got everything you need to know on your outline. But on the outline is one of his books that I highly recommend to you. It came out a few years ago called Teaching Science So That Students Actually Learn Science. It's a great book. And actually, if you're an administrator or have some influence in your school, everyone in your school should read that, no matter if they teach science in first grade or science in 12th grade. I really feel that that's a great book. The other credit I want to give to you, though, is to my advisor at NC State. Yes, a secular atheist man, Dr. Brandon Emig. He actually is no longer at NC State. He's back up in Pennsylvania. But he, even though he's not a Christian, so respected every conversation I had with him because he was my advisor. And he really challenged me to think about what it meant to teach science. So even there, and a great example of God using someone who's not one of his, at least at this point that I can tell, to really change me and therefore changing his own kingdom, because I'm obviously in a role where I am discipling those who I hope to be part of God's kingdom. So a couple other questions for you as we get going. Let's dive into this lecture-driven methodology for a moment. How many times do you normally lecture in a week? Oh, let's just be honest, no judging. This is the no judge zone. How many times? 5, 4, 3, 2, 3? So 3 days a week, yeah? Be bold, it's okay, we won't judge it. 4? That's kind of what I was getting at. Most people are like in the 4 range. What do you think? Anybody else? Okay. Why? Why do you do that? Sure. Other thoughts? Why? So are you basically going back through what was in the text? Kind of like an outline form. No, we're going to lecture through it. Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Other thoughts? Why do you do that? Absolutely. Absolutely. Excellent, yeah. Now, how do you learn best? This is a personal question. How do you learn best? Do you learn best when someone stands in front of you? I'm so sorry, got a text in the middle of a presentation. Do you learn best when someone stands in front of you and lectures to you for 50 minutes? Or do you learn best in another type of format? Let's be honest. How do you learn best? Doing it yourself. I am a hands-on, tactile learner. Until I touch it, feel it, smell it, whatever, I don't really get it. What about anybody else? Anybody just a pure visual? Some people are just really visual. We need to read the book, okay? Other thoughts. How do you learn best? Anybody in audio? Discussion. So time to hear, speak, and kind of think about it, process it at the same time. Okay, absolutely. I will tell you, most of us, if not all of us, do not learn best when lectured to for 55 minutes. Lecture does not equal learning. If you walk out of here with nothing else, that is the boom. Lecture does not equal learning. But how many times have we said that as a teacher? Well, we talked about this on Tuesday. You should know it by now. I lectured on this 5 weeks ago. What's wrong with you? Don't you remember what I lectured about? No. They have no clue what you lectured about. They might have been sitting there taking notes, but they weren't really processing what you were talking about. I'm a great note taker, by the way. I'm a great faker, right? You can sit here and talk to me for 55 minutes, and I will sit there and scribble awesome notes. But if you ask me what you talked about, let me go look at my notes again, because I really don't know, right? I really don't know what was really being said. Absolutely. When you get up in front of your classroom and you start lecturing, you have now basically forced your students into what's called a passive learning situation. They are passive learners, basically waiting for you to tell them what they need to know. And then yet we get frustrated when the kids ask the question, what do we need to know? We shouldn't get frustrated with that because we basically have forced them into that corner because we have, again, stood up in front of them as the transmitter of knowledge and we basically have told them what they need to know. So I'm going to tell you right now, again, don't get me wrong, there are times when you should lecture. I know you're going to be like, really? You said you're students. There's times when you should lecture, but I just feel like we all lecture way too much. Way too much. We, as classical Christian science educators, should not be teaching from this lecture methodology. It's truly not classical. Instead, we should be teaching from an inquiry-based methodology. So if I had to summarize, the whole point of my discussion today is right there. We need to change from a lecture methodology to an inquiry-based methodology, which is very different. It doesn't mean you'll never lecture, because you will. It's just you won't be lecturing as much, because that's not the way that you're operating all the time. You have these quotes in your handout, but I'd like to go ahead and read over them directly as well. These are from John Milton Gregory's Seven Laws of Teaching. It says, excite and direct the self-activities of the pupil, and as a rule, tell him nothing that he can learn himself. Make your pupil a discoverer of the truth. Make him find out for himself. Arouse the spirit of inquiry. True teaching, then, is not that which gives knowledge, but that which stimulates pupils to gain it. If we so prize this man's work, I don't know why we're lecturing. Because there's not a lick of lecturing in anything on that board. Is any of that lecture-based? None of it. It's all inquiry-based. Putting the student in the seat of discoverer instead of the receiving the transmission of knowledge from their teacher. So if we want to teach classically, we should be using this inquiry-based methodology. We should be inspiring our students to learn. We should be inspiring them to always want to inquire about the world around them. Now, one practical way that this can be done, so now we're going to start into the practical side of things, is through the use of something called process-oriented guided inquiry learning. Yes, that's a big old educational acronym called POGL. And you're welcome to look this up at some point, called the pogl.org. This is, a secular thing. This is not a classical Christian thing. But I think this is one way in which the secular world is outdoing us. We should claim that which is our own. Because this is classical. Inquiry-based methodology is classical in nature. So we need to claim it and name it. Because they have claimed it for themselves. Like, oh, we figured out this great thing. No. You're just figuring out, we're trying to recover, which was done for hundreds and thousands of years. A place where you can actually order guided inquiry lessons is Flynn Scientific. If you have taught in the high school level or even middle school or lower, you probably have ordered from them before. But they have some really, really great lessons. I'm actually going to go ahead and pass out to you now one of them. So this is... So coming out to you right now is actually an example of a POGL lesson that I had purchased through Flynn Scientific. So it's completely public domain. Obviously, you would need to purchase from them if you want all of the lessons, but they're fabulous. Once everybody has one, I'm actually going to run through literally a lesson, just a mini version of it, that I would teach in one of my ninth grade classes. I don't think I said that to you as we were getting started, just in case you know it's in my bio, but I teach ninth grade human physiology and 12th grade physics. So I'm one of those weird people that likes biology and physics all at the same time, because I love math too, as well as loving the human body and living organisms. Thank you so much for passing those out. So we're going to pretend that you're in my ninth grade human physiology class, and that's taught at an honors level, just so you kind of know where I'm at. And we are introducing today a new unit. The unit is the circulatory system. And before you start on any type of activity, you would be situated at tables with either two or three other people, so four to a table. And I would start by asking you guys some questions. And you would actually work as table mates to answer these questions. So here's literally the questions I would ask. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. With your table mates, I'm going to give you about 2 minutes to answer these questions. The questions are, why do you have a heart? Why do you have lungs? Why do you have blood vessels? Go. Right? And they would take a few minutes and they'd sit there and they'd kind of talk it out. Well, you got to have blood and it pumps the blood around. And, you know, and it's interesting. I kind of walk around the room and I hear what they're talking about. It's so much fun. And then after the 2 minutes, I say, okay, now pull out a piece of paper if you don't have paper out. And I want you, again, just one piece of paper per table group, to draw for me what you think the heart and lungs look like and how it's all hooked together. Oh, that's funny. Right, walking around and seeing what my ninth graders are drawing, it makes you a little sad. I'm like, okay, it's going to be all right. And then you got to just giggle because some of their pictures are just funny. And, of course, I give them the warning because they're 14 years old. Don't be stupid. Don't be inappropriate. Draw what you think they look like. And, of course, I'm roaming the room, so I'm seeing what they're doing. Why? Why do you think I spend time at the beginning of a unit or the beginning of a lesson asking them to do something which you might sit there and think, well, that seems frivolous. Seems like a waste of time. Yes, you have to know where they are. You have to know what they know. Otherwise, you are useless. You're womp, 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 and they don't care. Right? You can do handstands and somersaults in the front and think you're cool, and they don't care. Because you never stop to actually figure out where they are and how to get them to where you want them to go. So that's the first thing we do is we take time to actually assess where they are. And they, of course, have a hoot laughing at each other's drawings. Ha ha, you thought the heart was there. Now, I don't let them be, you know, unkind to each other, but it is fun for them to share. You're recognizing that they're people. They're not little automatons sitting in your classroom just waiting for the next little note to write down. No, they're people, and they want to express what they already know to you. Give them an opportunity to show them what you know or what they know. Them show you what they know. Now, after we do that, I would pass out the little handout that you have in front of you. And again, this comes right from a book of lessons that I bought from Flynn Scientific for 3 or 4 years ago. Okay, so this is something you can literally go home and order, and they're fabulous. I'm actually going to have you work in pairs, threes, I don't care. You're old enough to make that decision. And we're going to take about 3 minutes, and I literally want you to answer the question. We're going to do school. Now, you're going to work until you see the first stop sign. And the first stop sign is on the back of the first page. All right? Have fun. I'll be roaming the room. It's like school. I'll give you about 2 or 3 minutes. That's all you need.
Thank you.
Alright, ladies and gentlemen, let me go ahead and get your attention back up this way. So what did you notice about, actually, I'm going to rewind for a second and ask how many of you have seen these types of activities before or used them in your classrooms? I'm so happy. Good. This is new to most of you. Woo! Awesome. I love these. Alright, so now I'm going to ask you some questions as educators. What did you notice about this type of guided inquiry? I mean, we haven't really delved into what this is yet. That's where we're going. I just wanted to give you an example of it first. What did you notice about it? What was different about doing this as opposed to having me stand up here and say, now the circulatory system consists of a heart, lungs, and blood vessels, and the heart's problem. What was different? Say it again. It made you think. What else? Okay, there's information not on the drawing, right? So you're actually having to infer and actually talk out some things with people. Yeah. Absolutely. Other thoughts? What did you notice about this? Again, if we had more time to do the whole thing, you'd really see this. Anything about maybe how the questions are asked? I'm trying to lead you here to an idea. What did you notice about the question? Say it again. Okay, simple to harder, absolutely. From general to specific, absolutely. Very good. Yes, sir, I'm back. Yeah, the beautiful part is you actually can work through the rest of them. I'm just not going to spend class time doing that with us as a class, but it does that. So what it does is it presents to them a diagram. And I don't know if you hadn't realized, but interpreting diagrams is a scientific what? Skill. That's a scientific practice. So even within a little activity that I just did with my students to introduce the idea that you have two, or basically, you know, you have four chambers of the heart, but you got two sides of the heart, and you got stuff leaving and stuff coming in, like they're just being introduced to this again. Within this, they're actually having to practice doing science, which is taking a representation and interpreting from the representation, and vice versa. Question three. Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. So, absolutely. And I'll talk about that later. So, in essence, when I was talking about I would start with actually having them write what they know, it kind of starts with that. But in this case, I probably would just give them the rest of the packet just so they would have it. But sometimes I do that as well. Well, I basically guide them through it without necessarily having a handout. So there's all different ways that you can do that guided inquiry and make it very successful. It's just getting them out of being the receiver of knowledge to being the discoverer of knowledge. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, the beautiful thing is they realize very quickly, because I tell them, these are your notes. So this becomes what you would go back and study with. But no, I do it that way as well, where they have to kind of do it themselves. We're actually going to get to that too, making representations on your own. So yeah, great question or great comment. Now, what you'll notice too is that the guided inquiry follows a logical sequence from what is known to what is unknown. Going back to John Milton Gregory, this is how we're supposed to be teaching, right? We're supposed to be teaching from what is known to what is unknown and guiding them through the steps of getting from one place to another. Using guided inquiry really puts me, instead of being the transmitter of knowledge in the room, to be more of the expert in the room that's there to help guide them along in their discovery of the knowledge. Because you can't just let them free. You can't just be like, oh, learn what you want. No, they're not going to do that, right? We're human beings with a fallen nature. They're not going to stay on path. They're not going to learn what you want them to. They need guidance. But at the same time, I should not be sitting there just telling them what they need to know or just telling them the answer. They need to practice thinking and practice processing and practice working through the information for themselves. So great job. You'll also notice, actually turn to, it says page 4. It's actually the back side of page 2. You'll notice there's some extension questions with the guided inquiry. I love the extension questions because what it does is that after you've gone through this whole little mini lesson, it actually gets them to have to apply knowledge in a different context. Oh my goodness, I cannot stand when students say, well, I know how to do this problem, or I know about this, but they only know how to do it within the context that you originally showed them. They can't take it. They can't transfer their knowledge to another context. And what guided inquiry does is because they've had to build their knowledge as they went with you guiding them, they can take the knowledge from one context to another because they didn't learn it within just a formal context. This is what we want. This is what we want. We want students who can think and apply concepts outside of the original application. They can actually have usable knowledge instead of just knowledge that sits there and does nothing for them or for anyone else. So we're going to continue to walk through here. I actually want to show you, these are actually some of my ninth graders. Aren't they so sweet? I miss them already. Doing a guided inquiry on a kidney. Actually, we're going to talk about this because I use a model and a representation for this. That's very different. But here they are, and I actually have a video of one of my sections doing a guided inquiry. So I want to show that to you. Now, I'm going to apologize. I just taped it on my iPhone, so you may be able to pick up what they're saying, maybe not, but I just want you to view it for what it looks like, because my classroom does not look like an average classroom, and you're going to see why.
Good. I think the blues are in here. Yeah, they weren't quite big. They weren't quite small enough. Yeah.
Yeah,
I
think we think
they're supposed to go in that order. Because
Now, for those of you that are close enough, and again, I'm sorry if you couldn't view it very well, or again, I just taped it on my iPhone. What did you notice about my students? Sorry, I'm so used to work in a classroom. This is very awkward to be at a podium. I was just getting ready to move. Go to that side of the room. So what did you notice about my students as they were working? And I actually have some fellow colleagues in here who know these students, and these students were not asking for the camera because I told them not to. I actually warned them. I'm going to be videoing you, and if you act, like, different than you normally act, you're going to get in trouble. You need to be normal. And they were totally being themselves. I mean, those are how these students are. So they were engaged. What else did you notice? Yes. I love it. I love to hear them go back and forth. Your all's group up here was doing exactly what you want that. You want some argumentation in a healthy academic way. It's not argumentation of you're stupid, you're wrong. It's, well, I think the protein should have made it through. Why didn't the proteins make it through the kidney or through the glomerulus? Or why did the beads stay on? I mean, that's what they're arguing about. Why did that cell, red blood cell, stay on top and not go through? How exciting! You have students arguing about proteins. I mean, that's incredible. That's what you want. I can't tell you how happy I am when I walk through my classroom when we're doing these types of activities and you have people arguing about what should be going through the glomerular glands. That's awesome! And I hadn't said anything. Nothing. I've just been guiding them through their discovery of what God has already made. I mean, it's just awesome. Awesome, awesome. According to the seven laws of teaching, we are to be exciting the students' interest in our lessons. So we're going to kind of segue here from just talking about guided inquiry into talking about, okay, what else does this look like in the classroom? How do you right now currently try to generate interest in your lessons? I mean, how do you get them excited to get started in your classroom? Again, no judge zones. We're going to share. How do you get them excited about what you're going to do? Yes, ma'am. Absolutely. So food is a great briber. Yeah. Sure. So she mentioned hands-on activity is really what that is. It's a hands-on, you're presenting them a representation or a model of something they're studying. They just get to eat it afterwards, which is great. Other ways to excite interest in your lesson. Yes. That's exactly right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. One more. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. I can't help but be excited. I've been trying to keep it professional. I'm not ready to like, woo, isn't this great? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're going to get to all those, absolutely. But I want you to realize you have got to generate interest in your lesson. Ask yourself, why should my students care about this? Because guess what? They're not going to care. They're not. Don't be naive. Don't think you're better than you are. Oh, that was painful to say to myself. I'm not all that. There is no reason other than they're trying to be obedient, right, and do the right thing, honor God with their behavior, to pay attention to my lesson. Unless I generate them, or in them, excuse me, a need to know. Every lesson I ever teach, I ask myself that. Why do they need to know this? Why should they care? You've got to generate in them that need to know. And then you guide them through the process of finding out the answer. When you teach from this way, you'll have no problems with students doing work for you. I have students work hard for me, and they might not even get A's, but they're just like, Miss McDonald, I love your class. I get to think. We have a great time. You're always wanting me to think about things and figure stuff out. Uh-huh. And slowly but surely, you don't have as many people OCDing about A's. And slowly but surely, you don't have kids failing because they don't really care. They might be getting just a C, but at least they're kind of caring. They're like, hey, this is kind of cool. I get this. One way that you can generate in your students a need to know is by something that's a weird verb, but problematizing your lessons. Problematizing, that's a weird word, right? So what does that mean? If we're going to problematize something, what does that mean? Yes, yes, sir. Absolutely. So you don't have to turn everything into some deep problem for them to solve, but you do. You do want to give them questions to answer, problems that they want to figure out the answer to, because that's how you get them to work in order to figure those things out. So I'm actually going to give you an example here. And you do not have this in front of you. We're going to get to what else you have in front of you in just a moment. But let's say we're going to start learning about fluid mechanics and physics. And fluid mechanics, by its very nature, is such an awesome topic, right? But if you don't teach it the right way, all students see are these huge equations, right? Think of Bernoulli's equation and, oh, how do I figure out how to do this? Right? But if you teach it the right way, all of a sudden Bernoulli's equation is like, oh, I know what I'm doing. That's great. I understand the principles about what's going on. So what I do when I first start is I start by asking them some of these questions. And you don't have to do all three of them, but you could choose one or two. These are just three that I've used over the years. So, for instance, why do we put our thumbs over the garden hose to make the water come out faster? Oh, it really has nothing to do with pressure. A1V1 equals A2V2? If you change the cross-sectional area, you change the velocity. Now, of course, yes, there's changes in pressure. You're not completely incorrect. But that's actually the pure, if I was lecturing, well, A1, V1 equals A2, V2, meaning that the first cross-sectional area times the first velocity is equal to the second cross-sectional area times the second velocity. Well, who cares? Right? But if you sit there like, shh, and you start spraying them with water, or we take actually the lab faucets, and they have little aspirators on them. So, of course, there's a little small hole, and the water goes really fast. And then we take it off, and the water goes slower. Why does that happen? And I get them to make their own decision about it. I say, why do you think that's so? Oh, some of their explanations are just crazy, but it's fun. And they get to kind of dive through. And then we'll work together, and I'll guide them to actually get to the correct answer. But I start with this. The one that they never get is why we have water towers. I have never had a student actually get that right. They usually say something about, well, doesn't it maintain water pressure? And then I'll just ask how, and they have no idea. I'm like, I don't know. Why your face turns red when you do a handstand, right? Things like this, there are lots and lots of fun. And then we use guided inquiry style questions to actually get to the right answers. Now, in addition to just using guided inquiry, or the idea that we ask questions, and through those questions, we lead them to answers, we actually use, or I actually use, a lot of simulations. And I'm getting ready to show you some of those. This one is a FET simulation, P-H-E-T. How many of you guys have ever used FET simulations? Oh, if you haven't used them, you haven't lived. All right, they are awesome. So you don't have to have a techie school either and lots of money to make this happen. You could do this corporately as a class. So if you literally only have one computer and a projector, you can make this happen. But if you can at least get a few computers, so maybe two kids to a computer or something like that, you can make this happen. And it's revolutionary in your classroom. I'm not joking. Going from having to lecture this to having them play with it in real life, wow, they really get it. So here's actually an example. Let me show you how these little guys work if you've never played with them. For instance, I can turn on more water. I can take my little pressure gauge and literally see how the pressure increases with depth. That's a whole lot more effective than saying, now as you go down into a fluid, an incompressible fluid at that, the pressure increases with depth. Womp, 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 womp. But if they sit there and play like, hey, hey guys, look, if there's ink, it increases as it goes down. Hey, that's cool. Let's change it and make it gasoline. Oh, gasoline's less dense. So there's less what? Pressure. You have just taught them two huge concepts and I didn't do anything except guide them through it. But that's what my job is. My job is to be a guide for them. I'm not supposed to tell them something they can find out for themselves. I'm supposed to get everything in place so I can help them through the learning process. That's what it means to be a teacher. Even though I do love lecturing, I love talking, right? So it's great. I do love it. But it's not the most effective way. This is effective. And I can't tell you how many students tell me, oh, Ms. McDonald, I've struggled in science class my whole life. I get these. I know you do because I get them too. I can't imagine how much of a better student I would have been in school if I had stuff like this. Oh, this is so cool. We actually can change the shape of the pipe. Let's have fun. Let's make them go down. And then we can actually see how the pressure changes. 129. Oh, it's not this thing. But then let's do velocity. Velocity is 1.8. But it slows down where the area is what? Larger. That's cool. In essence, this is being a scientist. It's being able to analyze data and grab it for yourself and figure out what the concepts are. Instead of telling them the concepts, they're discovering the concepts. But you've, of course, planned all this and you're guiding them along the way. Now, these simulations, a lot of times, have great accompanying questions. So, like, for instance, I know this might be hard for you to see, but this is online. I did not type this up. I so don't reinvent the wheel. I have 4 children, a full life. I don't have time to reinvent the wheel. So I garner and gather as many resources as I can, and this is right on the FET website under this simulation. And you can see this is guided inquiry questions. You have them say, okay, as the sensors move deeper, how does the pressure change? Boom. They've been presented with a concept that you could have lectured, but you didn't have to. As you go all the way down. It's a really great, great way to teach your students. Now, FET simulations are not the only simulations out there with guided inquiry questions. Another one that I use a lot is SAS Curriculum Pathways. SAS, SAS, it's on your handout or your outline as well. These are ones that I use a lot. Very, very effective. ExploreLearning.com has some good ones. Be careful because sometimes you have to pay for those. But what I love about SAS and FET is they're all free, which is right up my alley. A lot of textbook publishers have these types of simulations or animations and questions that also are on the internet for free. You just got to kind of find out the sources. And I'm happy to share all the ones I've ever used. And I'd love to hear if you've used some as well for these. Again, the use of simulations and animations puts your student in the seat of discoverer, and you're there to assist them in their learning. Now, of course, after we would do any kind of lesson with guided inquiry or questions, we would go over those together. And that's where I can kind of say, hey, no, that's not right. Did another group have a different answer? And again, you're practicing the skill of argumentation and defending positions when you do it that way. I don't just sit there and tell them the answers. They have to answer for themselves and defend their position on that. I use animations and simulations in just about every lesson I teach. There's pretty much not a day that goes by that I'm not using one of these guys, either just as a visual as I'm talking or a lot of times as an inquiry situation. Let me show you a couple of these. This first one is a FET simulation on kinetic molecular theory. I love this one because, I mean, think about it. How can you really teach kinetic molecular theory without some sort of representation? I can remember learning it, and actually, I guess originally maybe junior high or middle school, and then in high school, and I just sat there and memorized my way through and got my A, but I had no idea what it meant, because there was no way to visualize what kinetic molecular theory really meant. Well, here we go. We're going to have some fun. Let's pump the handle. Pump, pump. All right, here's all of our little molecules. Of course, they're in a closed container. I love this one. I get so excited. All right, we're going to add some fire. Oh, let's add the fire. Oh, look! Oh my goodness! Embedded in this simulation is half a textbook of chemistry. I'm not joking! The temperature went up. The pressure went up. Look, there's a probably pretty soon if the pressure increases too much, the pot's going to blow. And there's this little man that you can add other little stuff to. And it's just so fun! This is science! Science is not boring lectures and textbooks and more. Because that's what it was for me. And hey, I'm still licensed enough to want to become a doctor. But this is incredible. Is it going to blow its top? Maybe not. Pressure keeps, spread out 2 atmospheres. You can, but you can change this and manipulate it. And, of course, there's guided inquiry that you could put with this. Let me show you another one. Like I told you, I teach physiology as well. And how in the world can you teach about electron transport chains without some sort of representation? You can't. You just can't. Otherwise, the students are just passively taking notes, memorizing their way through your class, and they know nothing. They know nothing. So I love this one. I'm not going to obviously have you listen to all this. It's a great one. But I love, look at the little electrons moving down the proteins and the hydrogen ions being pumped out. Ah, this is awesome. Awesome. If I had had this when I learned cellular respiration, I would have gotten it so much better. Because you can actually see the molecules moving. These are active processes, these models we have of how the human body, or actually any cell here, works. So you want to get excited for your kids. You want them to see how cool this is. Give them that opportunity to discover for themselves how these things work. And you're there to guide them along the way. Now, I also don't just use representations in class, and this kind of goes to what a gentleman over here was speaking of earlier. I require my students to make their own many, many times. So it kind of goes with what you were saying earlier. Now, this is actually what you saw a video of. This little cup and some string and some beads is a kidney. It's cheap. It cost me less than $10 for over 60 little cups of all this stuff, right? It's awesome. Anybody want to see if they can figure out how this is a model of a kidney? All right, I'll help. I can't go off my set. Anybody know what the screen represents? No? It's called the glomerulus. It's actually a ball of capillaries that are leaky, right? So capillaries are leaky. They let stuff through. What do you think the cup is, where the water is? That's the kidney. That's the nephron. Is actually the name for that part. Why do only the little beads go through? Yeah, it's okay, be bold. Right, because it's a filter. Ah, I could easily sit up there and lecture and be so much, you know, more efficient with my time, I guess you would say, and say, okay, the glomerulus is a bowl of capillaries, and that bowl of capillaries acts as a filter for your blood. And the blood comes in from the renal artery and goes to the glomerulus, and those cells that are too large to fit through the screen or fit through the glomerulus don't make it through. They stay in your blood. Those are red blood cells, white blood cells, and proteins. Those items that are less in size make it through the glomerulus. Those are amino acids, glucose, salt, water, and urea. Okay, that took me, what, 3 minutes? But do you have any clue what I just said? Yeah. But you have them build this, and they're like, oh, I get it. The big beads can't make it through. Right. What are the big beads? Red blood cells, white blood cells, proteins. Oh, I get it. And all of a sudden, the kidney becomes this, I get it. It filters based upon size. Yep, it does. And yet they get to practice being a scientist, building a model of how they think something works. And, of course, I've guided them through this process. If you remember in the video, they had little handouts with pictures and questions and that type of thing, so they're not left to their own devices. But this is powerful. Now, I have lots of examples of having them make their own representations. I have them, for instance, make posters that have to describe exocytosis and all the endocytosis, I guess that's the right word, which you can do. I have them make posters showing the representation of how a marathon runner uses photosynthesis and respiration. Because you are, right? You're benefiting from the oxygen and the glucose that was made in photosynthesis. You burn it in cellular respiration. I actually have them make little videos of mitosis. Now, I am not a techie kind of person. So how I do these videos are called stop motion videos, is we take lots of pictures. And then, honestly, I gave it to a senior boy and said, can you make this a video? But he was like, oh, Mr. McDonald, it's so easy. All you do is string your pictures together. Okay, can you do it next year for me? But anyway, but it was so much fun. So let me show you my 9B here section video of mitosis. Now, grant you, they are 14. It's made of pipe cleaners. Different groups use different colors, but go with it. It's really pretty cool. And voila, cytokinesis happens. All right, very good. I mean, hopefully you get a picture. Is that professional grade? Would I publish that? No, but you should have seen those kids. They were like, I get it, Miss McDonald. This is so cool. Look at our video. And they judged each other's videos, right, because class A, B, and C. And they were like, which one's better? I mean, it just was a great day. It was lots of fun. They actually got mitosis so much better than if I had just lectured through with pictures. Interphase, let me start with prophase and prometaphase. Just so much more effective. Now, don't get me wrong. We did go over all that terminology. But this just, again, put them in seat of discoverer instead of that past of receiver for information. Something else that my students know I am famous for, they tease me for it, and I don't care. They know that I'm very comfortable with my nerdiness and my idiosyncrasies, and one of them is I love flowcharts. I love them. Right? I think all of us in science love flowcharts because they show process. And so I have them create flowcharts for everything under the sun. Ms. McDonald, are we making another flowchart today? You betcha. Let's go. Because it shows process. It helps our brain organize. Well, then this, and then this, and then that. We also make concept maps. How many of you all have ever made your students make a concept map? Oh, they're awesome. I just love them. A concept map starts with a main concept and has all these other concepts bridging off and then continuing to bridge off and continuing to bridge off, or branch off, I guess would be the more proper word. And it is a fabulous way to organize gobs of information. And the students love them. Well, because guess what? This is actually how our brains kind of work. So they're highly, highly effective for remembering, and actually not even just remembering, but understanding information. Have your students, let me go back for a second, sorry, have your students practice with information. I know, again, my students kind of get tired of me saying this, I think, sometimes, but I tell them, science is about practicing what you're doing, what your understanding is. We're actually going to do this. We're going to see what happens, and then we're going to do it again. We're going to see, did we get the same result? Is this model still explain what we saw? Going going through concept maps, going through flow charts, it's so much better than just lecture, take notes, review, test. So much better for them in actually developing problem solvers and thinkers. Now, I'm going to kind of run through just a couple other topics that I think are worth mentioning as we're going through. I'm so sorry, what time do you all have? Okay, so we're done in 5 minutes? Okay, so what I'm going to do is just highlight a few of these because I want to make sure that I give at least a couple minutes to questions. So I guess I had time more than I had time to show you, but hopefully you were able to see some. I just want to make sure you guys get, or stop marrying to your, or stop being married to your textbook. Divorce it now, all right? It's a godly divorce. It's all good. So just stop being married to them. You should teach a course and not a textbook. Textbooks are resources. And I know different people have different ideas about what is out there in terms of what the AP board uses or the next generation science standards. I'm telling you, I think they're great resources to go to just to see what big ideas the world is saying you should teach in science. I use a lot of them because they're good. They are. For one of the big ideas is actually that living organisms use free energy to grow, reproduce, and maintain homeostasis. I'm going to teach that big idea. And then all my other little units are going to spiral back to that big idea. So when a student leaves my classroom, yeah, they might forget about the glomerulus and the kidney, but they won't forget that it's about homeostasis because that's the big idea. Do this. Instead of just going through every part of the textbook or every single unit, just make sure that your units or your chapters, however you want to organize, continue to go back to big ideas because that's what you want your students to know. Really briefly, too, science is a discipline of doing. Have you not noticed that every activity that I've talked about today with, in terms of inquiry-based methodology is what? You can say that, right? Hands-on. Because science is hands-on. It's doing. Have your students not just do the recipe-style experiments. They are easy, and sometimes you have to do them for safety's sake. Have them come up with either additional questions that they could be answering with an experiment. Give them some freedom. My physics students get a lot of freedom because physics is relatively safe. Chemistry, not so much. You don't want people getting burned in the laboratory. But, for instance, I'll give them a multimeter and some batteries and resistors and wire and alligator clips, that kind of thing. I'll just say, I want this circuit. I want a circuit that has resistors of this ohms and this many ohms or has two parallels and one series. Go. Well, how do I do that, Mr. McDonald? You know how to do it. Go. Well, okay. Give them that permission to think. Instead of drawing out what circuit you want them to do, give them the material. Tell them, if you've been in my class, you should know what a parallel and series circuit is. So I want two parallels, I want a series. I don't care how you do them, just make it happen. Okay. You should see the excitement that comes on their faces. And I'm like, this is really great. And then they start arguing, no, the parallel should be here. No, it should be there. That's awesome. That's learning. Learning is not just mimicking what I wanted them to do. I need them to do it for themselves. Also, have them come up with questions that they can answer as much as possible as you're able and obviously as it's safe. Virtual labs, don't be ashamed to use them. They are awesome. Especially for those types of things in biology that are very expensive, like biotechnology. The top one is actually a gel electrophoresis lab. And I don't know about you, but gel electrophoresis. Are very expensive. And so this little virtual lab literally takes them step by step through how to do a gel electrophoresis, from actually removing the DNA with a micropipette, putting it into the wells of the gel, actually running the gel, what potential DNA distribution would look like in terms of how far it goes on the gel, et cetera. So absolutely fabulous. Please use them. Don't be ashamed to. I use them quite often in my classroom. And then lastly, I want to make sure I do mention, and I think we're just going to do questions, the last piece of paper I gave you is an example of, actually not a lesson that I would pass out to students, but the last piece of paper that I gave you is an example of literally my own lesson plan of how I would teach or introduce buoyancy. I want my students to think, so I have to teach them how to recognize patterns, how to recognize when things are similar and different. You might think, well, that's kind of juvenile. No, that's science. Science is all about pattern recognition. And how is it the same? And how is it different? And why? So you can read through this. I won't insult your intelligence. I know you can read. So you can read through and see how I do that, and you can see the questions I ask. And actually, it goes back to what the gentleman up here said again. I'm sorry to pick on you. But this is an example where they're going to do it all themselves. Because this was literally my plan, and I was just asking these questions, but they would be working independently in their groups with it. I won't go into a lot with this, but I teach my students how to derive formulas. Robbie Scott Jane had a little bit on this yesterday in his talk with calculus and physics, so I won't go into a lot of it. But the second bullet point, literally I sometimes yell this, like in happiness, but math is a language! Practice speaking it! Right? And they're like, no, yes! Numerical sentences are just like English sentences, and you don't get better unless you try to write them yourself. And my students, there's such freedom in this. I can remember one girl who has struggled in math her whole life. She said to me at the end of her senior year, she just graduated, Miss McDonald, I actually get math a little bit now. Praise God. It's just a language. Yeah. It's just a language. So have your students do that for themselves. And lastly, make sure that you are making certain that your students are articulate and winsome. Oh, I thought you could go over. All right, so lastly, I do want to mention this. I'm sorry, I hope I don't... We still have time for some questions. So the whole title of my thing is, well, how do you get them to love it? You're probably like, she never got to that part. I actually did the whole time. Because how you get your kids to love science is you teach them from an inquiry-based methodology. I have literally outlined for you how I basically teach. And I have never, in all my 10 years, and now I teach over 120 students a year, I've never had a student tell me they didn't like science. I get the, Miss McDonald, you inspired me to become a doctor. You inspired me to study physics. I know I only got a C, but I think I want to try. Go for it. Because you've given them that sense of wonder. Every child ever born has a wonder about the universe. Every one of them. There's not one. I have four, and it's never failed me with mine. They love the world. How does that work, Mom? Why did that thing do that? What happens, and I'm sorry to say, is we happen. We lecture to them. They see school as this list of things to do and to memorize and to, and they lose that sense of awe and wonder. And what you can do by teaching from an inquiry-based methodology is you can put them back in the seat of the three-year-old. How does that work? I want to know why that light bulb burns orange and that one burns white. Why? If you instill in them and continue to instill in them a sense of wonder, they will work for you. They may not get an A, but they're going to work for you. And ultimately, it's going to lead them to wisdom, greater understanding, and ultimately, it leads them to worship. And this is what we want. Because we're in the business of raising a whole disciple, a whole generation of Christ, or excuse me, disciples for Christ. And so this is what I do. And so I thank you for our time went very fast. I thank you for listening. I hope that you learned something today that you could take home. If not, even that we could just have a discussion. So I'm happy to take questions. We won't do it formally, but if you have questions, I'm happy to receive them up here. Thank you again for your time, and I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day. I think I had, there might have been something in the back, but you're welcome to take one. Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Andrew. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Very nice.
Thank you.